The Sunstone Foundation presents a documentary analysis of the Zelf episode, recorded live at the 1989 Sunstone Symposium, held August 23rd through 26th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We take you now to the University of Utah campus, where the program is about to begin.
This is going to be a real rush job here. I read through my paper and 50 minutes later, I realized this isn't going to work. So basically, as a prelude to what I'm going to talk about today, I want to describe exactly what I'm doing here. I'm focusing on an event that occurred in church history in 1834, where Joseph Smith and some of his colleagues who were on Zion's camp dug up the bones, of an Indian from a burial mound. This has had significant import for Book of Mormon interpreters. This particular piece and what you're going to hear today is basically skimming the surface of a much more detailed analysis of the Zelf episode that will appear in a much lengthier chapter that will be part of a book that I'm editing. And the title of that chapter is, quote, "Wandering Over the Plains of the Nephites," end quote, Joseph Smith on the Book of Mormon. And so basically I'm going to be treating the topic of Joseph Smith as an interpreter of the Book of Mormon. And with those comments, we'll go ahead and proceed. During evening discussions to an attentive audience of parents and siblings, Joseph Smith Jr. gave what his mother characterized as, quote, "some of the most amusing recitals that could be imagined," end quote, about the ancient Aboriginal Americans. With vivid precision, Smith, quote, would describe their dress, mode of traveling, and the animals upon which they rode, their cities, their buildings, with every particular, their mode of warfare, and also their religious worship. This he would do, Lucy Mack emphasized, with as much ease, seemingly, as if he had spent his whole life with them, end quote. According to Mother Smith, these narrations occurred in the years between Moroni's initial visit and her son's eventual acquisition of Cumorah's Gold Bible. Years later, the adult prophet claimed that the angelic messenger had, quote, "informed him concerning the Aboriginal inhabitants of this country, and further had shown who they were and from whence they came, a brief sketch of their origin, progress, civilization, laws, and governments," end quote. Smith remarked that in the same angelophony, he was, quote, "told where there was deposited some plates on which were engraven an abridgment of the records of the ancient prophets that existed on this continent," end quote. Quote, "this important and interesting book," Smith claimed, "was nothing less than," quote, "the history of ancient America," end quote. On the basis of this rudimentary understanding of the Book of Mormon as a history of the origin of the American Indian, numerous early Mormon converts embraced fellowship in the fledgling Church of Christ. This continued as the dominant interpretation of the Book of Mormon throughout the 19th century. With the rise of modern scientific methods, this traditional understanding of the Book of Mormon has been called into question and revised by some. An increasing number of Mormon scholars and students of the history of the ancient Americas are concluding that the civilizations discussed in the Book of Mormon could not have inhabited such an immense body of land. These students have revised the traditional geography and substituted a limited geography with Book of Mormon history occurring in a small region in Mesoamerica. Creative efforts are made by these revisionist Book of Mormon geographers to harmonize Joseph Smith's statements on the Book of Mormon with these new theories. Traditionalist Book of Mormon geographers have resisted these new trends and have argued that revisionist views are at odds with inspired sentiments expressed by the prophets from Joseph Smith to the present. Still, both traditionalists and revisionists share literalistic faith assumptions. Both schools of thought firmly believe that the Book of Mormon is a literal history or record of a group of people who actually existed somewhere in America. A third approach has also appeared in Mormon academic circles. This group of scholars and students can be designated as Book of Mormon critics in the tradition of their Catholic and Protestant counterparts who are biblical critics. Book of Mormon critics are committed to the idea that the historical and literary critical methods of secular scholars, although by no means infallible, are the best and most reliable methods for studying sacred as well as secular literature. Book of Mormon critics thus differ from both camps of Book of Mormon literalists, the revisionists and traditionalists. Book of Mormon critics are willing to follow to their logical conclusions the findings of New World archaeologists, even if this means rejecting the Book of Mormon as a story of civilizations which actually existed in the Americas. Book of Mormon critics are little interested in harmonizing Joseph Smith's pronouncements with perceived theories or preconceived theories about geography, but rather concerned with establishing the original context and perceived meaning of such pronouncements. In this study, I will employ the methods of Book of Mormon critics in order to consider Joseph Smith himself as a Book of Mormon interpreter. The first issue of concern is locating Joseph Smith's views along the continuum of Book of Mormon interpretation. Are Smith's pronouncements extensions of the Book of Mormon text, or are they independent from the text, providing the founding gestures of the history of Book of Mormon interpretation? The evidence suggests that Smith's views should be considered as both. He thus occupies a unique position. Because his pronouncements clearly interpret the text, they constitute the initial stages of the history of interpretation. But a number of Smith's interpretations additionally claim to have come through the inspired source from which he originally obtained the Book of Mormon text, and thus legitimately extend the inspired text. The Zelf episode provides a case study of Smith's unique interpretive position. This event occurred in the spring of 1834. Joseph Smith, under divine directive, had formed a paramilitary organization called the Army of Zion. It was their intention to reclaim land in Missouri, which had been taken from their fellow Mormons. The troops encountered a large number of Indian burial mounds. On Tuesday, the 3rd of June, 1834, the skeletal remains of an Indian, probably of the Hopewell culture, were exhumed. Smith subsequently had a vision identifying the person as a white Lamanite named Zelf. This episode has plagued Book of Mormon interpreters for over half a century. It poses a fundamental obstacle for revisionist geographers who conclude no Book of Mormon events transpired in the eastern United States. Thus, traditionalists have used this episode from church history to bludgeon revisionists. Each side has tried to make the discovery of Zelf conform to its views on Book of Mormon geography. Only recently have serious efforts been made to gather together the sources which might enable a detailed analysis of the Zelf incident. In this paper, I will analyze these sources in some detail and try to untangle some of the interpretive knots which have been tied by this intriguing incident and the reports written about it. And basically, we want to start here with the history of the church. This center section here, the center column, and it's in the handout that everyone has, is taken from the history of Joseph Smith that was published in the Times and Seasons in 1846. And so basically, we'll start with that. And my concern here, just to give you an overview, is not so much with the content of the information it contains at this point, but I'm more concerned with its makeup. What were the sources that were lay behind it? What were the redactional tendencies of the editors and so on? The history of the church, or history of Joseph Smith, as it was initially published in the Times and Seasons, was attributed to Joseph Smith, but was in actual fact compiled from a number of sources. Drawing on sources as disparate as Smith's dictation to his associates' journals and memoirs and even anti-Mormon publications, the editors of the history redacted these sources together to form a first-person narrative of the life of Joseph Smith. The entry on the Zelf episode is no exception. Compelling literary evidence suggests that the entry is an amalgamation of two eyewitness sources, the journal, or more correctly, memoirs of Heber C. Kimball and the journal of Wilford Woodruff. Now, basically, I don't have up here, and I don't have on an overhead, the full journal entry for either of them. But this is not technically, I don't think we would consider it technically one of Heber C. Kimball's journals or diaries. It's a published document, and to my knowledge, there's no existing manuscript for it. But we'll get into this a little bit more on some of the evidences that are in favor of it being a source behind the history. The most difficult of the Kimball and Woodruff journals to establish as a source for the history is without question that of Heber C. Kimball. We know from the historical record that Kimball's diaries were used by the editors of the history, but the extracts from Heber C. Kimball's journal are evidently reminiscences which were not published until 1845, 2 years after the Zelf story was recorded in the manuscript history, the document which eventually became the official history. No original of the Kimball journal extracts has survived. Because the literary parallels are so stark, there can be little doubt that either Kimball was dependent on the history, or the history editors were dependent on Kimball. If we hypothesize, and I want to go through two arguments here. I want to look at both. Okay, which is it? Is it Kimball dependent on the history, or the history dependent on Kimball? If we hypothesize that a manuscript containing Kimball's extracts existed prior to the writing of the manuscript history, it helps account for the parallels between the two documents. For example, the history follows Kimball's chronology, with the exception of three brief sentences. Furthermore, the history reproduces Kimball's editorial remarks about the landscape, in some instances verbatim. The history draws on the main theme of Kimball's journal, his description of the topography. Now, if we argue the opposite, okay, that Kimball was dependent on the history, we run into some interesting problems. The converse of this hypothesis, that the history predates the Kimball extracts, seems to be supported by the fact that the earliest version extant of the Kimball material does postdate the writing of the manuscript history. However, an enormous problem comes with accepting this model. If Kimball drew upon the history, then we would have to theorize that he just coincidentally borrowed only from those portions of the history which have no parallels in Wilford Woodruff's journal. Additionally, we would need to explain why Kimball characteristically replicates the entire entry from the history, but on this day, for the 3rd of June, 1834, he rejects part of the history entry and copies only part of it, rejecting only that which parallels Woodruff. Because of the problems associated with this dependency model, I believe that the editors of the history used an earlier, no longer extant version of Kimball's extracts from his journal. Next one we want to consider is the Wilford Woodruff Journal. Wilford Woodruff's encounter with the Zelph Mound was not his last experience with Indian mounds. On the 24th of May, 1839, the fledgling Apostle Woodruff and five of his fellow quorum members visited 20 mounds and, quote, saw the grave of a Lamanite chief, end quote. Woodruff was struck by these encounters and became the most prolific chronicler of the Zelph episode. Six accounts traceable to him are included in this study alone. Woodruff's journal was undoubtedly used as a source for the creation of the history entry. As with Kimball's journal extracts, the evidence for dependency is primarily literary in nature. We don't have the same problem, though, in chronology here, because Woodruff's journal entry on the Zelph episode almost certainly dates from around the mid to late 1834 period, because at the beginning of 1835, he begins his day books, where he chronicles the events on a daily basis. So in all likelihood, that particular entry was written prior to that time, and that predates the writing of the manuscript history by almost a decade. The same textual or literary arguments which confirm the dependence of the history on the Kimball journal can be made for a similar connection between the history and the Woodruff journal. In two important blocks of text, the larger one detailed above and the third one, and here I'm talking about, by the third one I mean right in this unit right here, and by the large one is everything from here above. Okay. The editor of the history follows the order of the Woodruff journal. Language parallels also exist. In almost every case, the parallels within both blocks are virtually word for word. The parallels are actually closer in the history's earlier drafts, the manuscript history of the church, books A1 and A2. The name of the military prophet, for instance, follows Woodruff's spelling Onondagas instead of Omendagas, as in the history. Perhaps the strongest evidence for dependence of the history on the Woodruff Journal is the parallel in editorial comments as well as in the description of the words of Joseph Smith. This parallel in editorial comments was also characteristic of the connections between the Kimball Journal and the history. An oral tradition stemming from Joseph Smith would account for the similarity in the report of what Joseph Smith said, but not for reproducing Woodruff's personal observations about the event. For these reasons, order, language, editorial comments, the editor of the history must have had access to Woodruff's journal or a copy of it. When the history, Woodruff's journal, and Kimball's journal are compared side by side, two interesting and important phenomena become apparent. First, the history's parallels with Kimball and Woodruff occur in relatively large blocks with scarcely any overlap between Kimball and Woodruff. Within the blocks, almost every word and phrase matches. Second, it is evident that the two sources complement each other thematically. Kimball, this is talking about the actual journal entries now, Kimball focuses predominantly on the topography of the landscape and mentions the content of Smith's vision only in passing at the end of his entry. In contrast, Woodruff is preoccupied with the content of Smith's revelation and virtually excludes mention of the terrain in which Zelph was exhumed. An editor might then have logically amalgamated the two versions to form the history entry. So basically what he's done is he's read the two entries. One focuses on the topography, on the landscape, what it looked like, and the other one focuses on the content of the vision. So as a result, he amalgamates those two in actually a very logical way, focusing predominantly on those two areas. I was going to get into some of the things dealing with the manuscript history, but to be honest with you, I think it would just complicate it too much. The manuscript history is the document that was written in 1843 that predates the published version. And you don't have this in your handout, so you'll need to look up here at it. But if you want to compare it with the center column on the three-column parallel that you saw just before, you can do so. What I'm going to do in the chapter is I'm going to focus on some of the changes that are made in the manuscript history. The changes were made evidently after the published version came out. And the changes for some people involved in Book of Mormon geography are significant. For example, the deletion of Hill Cumorah and things like that. And I will be dealing with that because that's an issue that needs to be studied in detail. Additionally, other sources that I just want to bring to your attention as we go through here. Wilford Woodruff's autobiography, an important document written in the 1850s. This particular segment is written in his handwriting, and basically it follows the same tradition, the same editorial tradition that you find in the writing of the manuscript history. That is, that this is an amalgamation of Woodruff's own journal, augmented with additional details that weren't in his journal, and then additionally revised with the published history. And it's intriguing because occasionally Woodruff will actually neglect his journal and go with the reading that's in the published history in the very place where the published history is dependent on his journal. And so it's kind of an interesting phenomenon that occurs. Like, for example, in his journal, he says that Onondagas was known from the Hill Cumorah or East Sea to the Rocky Mountains. In the published history, that reads that he was known from the Hill Cumorah or Eastern Sea to the Rocky Mountains. And in the autobiography, he goes with the version as it appears in the published history. Pardon me? Let's see, I think I mentioned that at the beginning. That's 1845. Yeah, that was 2 years after the writing of the manuscript history. That's why it has a chronological problem. We also have a source that stems from a conversation with James E. Talmadge. It was actually a dictated document where Woodruff gave a dictation of the content of the experience. I want to focus now. Let's see. And additionally, we also have Wilford Woodruff and Abraham Cannon's journal, as well as James E. Talmadge's journal. Maybe I can comment on them briefly. One of the reasons why I included them in the handout that you have is because Ken Godfrey just recently published a piece through Farms in which he compiled a number of the sources. And there were three primary sources which he does not have, which I have in my study. And these are two of them. And so they're part of the handout. The other one is from Eber D. Howe that was published in November of 1834. That's also part of the handout. But if you turn now to that page, it's the second page in, page number three, I guess, Woodruff and the Cannon and Talmadge journals. Wilford Woodruff, on at least two other occasions, related the events surrounding the discovery of Zelph. They were recorded in the journals of Abraham Cannon and James Talmadge. Because Woodruff was not directly involved in the composition of these two accounts, they present a distinct set of interpretive problems. The two accounts sometimes contradict Woodruff's other sources, but in the same instances contradict each other. For example, in his journal, Woodruff simply states that, quote, Joseph had a vision respecting the person, end quote. In his autobiography, he elaborates that, quote, on Tuesday the 3rd, Joseph, feeling anxious to learn something about or concerning this man, prayed to the Lord, and the Lord gave him a vision in open day while lying in his wagon, end quote. Cannon's account of the sermon by Woodruff still has, quote, the prophet lying in his wagon, end quote, but in contrast to Woodruff's autobiography, the revelation transpires, quote, the next day, end quote, implicitly Wednesday the 4th. Talmadge agrees with the autobiography that the history of Zelph was revealed on the same day as the discovery of the skeleton, but now it happened, quote, that night, end quote, instead of an open day. It is difficult and perhaps impossible to ascertain with certainty if the discrepancies originated with Woodruff or his chroniclers, Cannon and Talmadge. Woodruff was undeniably not beyond contradicting himself. Still, it cannot be ruled out that the anomalies can be attributed to Cannon and Talmadge. And now we get to really the bulk of the paper in a more interpretive piece on the Zelph episode. And if you turn the page in your handout, you'll see a parallel between Reuben McBride's journal and Wilford Woodruff's. Reuben McBride has left us the most concise account of the discovery and interpretation of the exhumed Indian bones. He succinctly states that, quote, a skeleton was dug up, end quote, and the bones were interpreted by Smith as belonging to a man named Zelph, a great warrior, a man of God, and a white Lamanite. All of these terms are familiar from the Wilford Woodruff journal entry. Of all the primary documents, Woodruff's journal account and McBride's most closely paralleled each other. McBride composed his account in three stages, and each phrase in McBride's journal finds an equivalent in Woodruff's. Clearly, then, striking parallels exist between the two accounts. The next important question becomes, what is the nature of the relationship? The parallels here differ from the parallels which I have considered between the history and the Kimball and Woodruff documents. The history, we have seen, is based on the journal accounts and parallels them in order and structure as well as in content. Between the McBride and Woodruff journals, there is no such parallel of order or structure. Often the parallels seem to appear randomly. The account includes additional material. But the agreements are more important than the differences. McBride and Woodruff agree most strikingly in words when they quote Joseph Smith and disagree most consistently when they do not. It seems plausible, then, to hypothesize that both documents derive their information from Joseph Smith's oral account of his Zelph vision. If this explanation is correct, and Joseph Smith is the common denominator between the two sources, then McBride and Woodruff likely come closest to Smith's original language. Even though McBride is one of the briefest accounts of the Zelph episode, its value as a primary source demands close scrutiny, particularly when set alongside the account of Wilford Woodruff. Of primary importance are two phrases which are not only common to McBride and Woodruff, but are also unique to them. The first phrase appears in McBride as, quote, the curse was taken off in part, end quote. This phrase is identical in meaning, if not wording, to Woodruff's, quote, the curse was taken from him, or at least in part, end quote. The dilemma posed by these similar phrases is this. Although both sources are saying the same thing, it is not exactly clear what they are saying. The phrase comes more sharply into focus if we first consider a related phrase McBride and Woodruff both share as well. White Lamanite. Kimball's journal and also Moses Martin's journal and Woodruff's brief synopsis, Leaves from My Journal, mention no ethnological identity for Zelph. Those who mention Zelph's heritage unanimously agree that he was a white Lamanite. This designation is consistently used by Woodruff, by McBride, and also by Hancock. Howe more obliquely refers to Zelph as a celebrated general among the Lamanites, which tells us literally nothing about his ethnicity. The origin of the American Indian skin color was the subject of considerable speculation in the early 19th century. The Book of Mormon provided a prophetic solution. In the Book of Mormon, all Lehites are of the same ethnic background and the same skin pigmentation, white. Shortly after their arrival in the New World, the Hebrew inhabitants split into two competing factions named after their initial leaders, the Lamanites and the Nephites. The Lamanites, as a result of their increasing decadence, become a community of indolent scavengers who eventually exterminate their civilized contrasts, the Nephites. Key elements of this story have antecedents in Joseph Smith's environment. For example, Ethan Smith, in 1825, wrote an entire book espousing an Israelite origin for the American Indian. He also theorized that, quote, it is highly probable that the more civilized part of the tribes of Israel, after they settled in America, became wholly separated from the hunting and savage tribes of their brethren, and that the latter lost the knowledge of their having descended from the same family with themselves, that the more civilized part continued for many centuries, the tremendous wars were frequent between them and their savage brethren, till the former became extinct, end quote. The Reverend Smith additionally popularized Indian legends that purportedly told, quote, that in the nation from which they originally came, all were one color, and their former ancestors away in a distant region from which they came were white, end quote. The earliest intimation of the importance of skin color in the Book of Mormon is Nephi's awestruck comment upon seeing the future mother of Jesus, quote, I beheld a virgin, and she was exceedingly fair and white, end quote. This language is elucidated as Nephi sees in his panoramic vision the arrival of the Gentiles, who in contrast to the dark and loathsome progeny of his brothers, are, quote, white and exceedingly fair and beautiful, like unto my people before they were slain, end quote. As Nephi notes, the Lamanites were first, quote, white and exceedingly fair and delightsome, end quote, like the rest of Lehi's entourage. But because of decaying morality and religiosity in the Lamanite community, God deemed it necessary to create a physical barrier to ensure that that Lamanite sacrilege would not spread through intertribal marriage. With arresting racial innuendo, the Book of Mormon author describes God's maledictory mark distinguishing the Lamanites from their kinfolks. God, through a mighty act, quote, did cause a skin of blackness to come upon them, end quote. So, quote, that they might not be enticing, end quote, to their Nephite neighbors. Such is the Book of Mormon account of the origin of Indian skin pigmentation. Nephi's younger sibling, Jacob, noted the contemptuous ridicule that the Lamanites were subjected to because of, quote, the cursing which has come upon their skins, end quote. Jacob then rebuked his Nephite audience for their waywardness, warning remained unrepentant, quote, their skins will be whiter than yours when ye shall be brought with them to stand before the throne of God, end quote. In a charitable move, Jacob enjoins his people through revelation to, quote, revile no more against them because of the darkness of their skins, end quote. Quote, and the skins of the Lamanites, Mormon observes, were dark, according to the mark which was set upon their fathers, which was a curse upon them, end quote. What had been placed by a mighty act of God, according to the Book of Mormon, could only be removed by a mighty act of God. On at least two occasions, the curse of the dark skin is removed from Lamanites who become Christians. The Lamanite colony, which assumed the tribal name Anti-Nephi Lehis, after their conversion, quote, began to be a very industrious people, yea, and they were very friendly with the Nephites. Therefore, they did open a correspondence with them, and the curse of God did follow them no more, end quote. Just a few years prior to the appearance of the resurrected Christ, a company of Lamanites converted to Jesus. This conversion miraculously resulted in, quote, their curse being taken from them, and their skins were white like unto the Nephites. And their young men and their young daughters became exceedingly fair, and they were called Nephites. In addition to such incidents, Nephi promised his descendants who convert to Christ will have, quote, their scales of darkness fall from their eyes, and many generations shall not pass away among them, save there shall be a white and delightsome people, end quote. It is in this context, provided by the Book of Mormon, that Zelph's identification as a white Lamanite should be understood. In Widger's journal, the phrase, the curse was taken from him, or at least in part, follows and explains white Lamanite. In McBride, white Lamanite follows the curse was taken from him in part. Ultimately, both are saying the same thing. Zelph was originally a dark-skinned Lamanite who, through conversion to Christ, had the curse rescinded and his color reverted to the white pigmentation of his Nephite relatives. The more difficult phrase to interpret in Woodruff and McBride is the brief qualification of the curse being removed, at least in part. The interpretive difficulty is exacerbated by the fact that this phrase is foreign to the Book of Mormon and other Joseph Smith writings. The phrase may well recall Zelph's biological past. Although Zelph's conversion resulted in a transformation in his skin color, he cannot escape his biological link to his Lamanite lineage, or it may be that Zelph was miraculously changed in color and not his offspring. Whatever the case, it is certain that Zelph was a white Lamanite because the curse was taken from him, at least in part. The second phrase, unique to Woodruff and McBride, appears in McBride as, quote, was known from the Atlantic to the Rocky Mountains. This phrase parallels Woodruff's, quote, was known from the Hill Cumorah or East Sea to the Rocky Mountains, end quote. But with two subtle yet important distinctions. The first distinction may be attributed to an inadvertent slip on McBride's part when he squeezed his final annotation between the lines at the end of the June 3rd entry. McBride implies that Zelph had attained such notoriety, but all other sources addressing this question ascribe such fame to Onondagas. Woodruff initially records Smith saying that Zelph was enlisted under the great prophet Onondagas that was known from the Hill Cumorah or east seat of the Rocky Mountains. Area that Onondagas, quote, held sway and command over the armies of the Nephites, end quote. This interpretation is reflected in other sources. In his 1892 dictation, for example, Woodruff similarly notes that Onondagas's, quote, dominion covered an immense body of country, end quote. Levi independently supports this emphasis on role, claiming that Smith said, quote, this land was called the land of desolation and Onondagas was the king. The second distinction between McBride and Woodruff in reporting this phrase is significantly more complex and controversial. Both mention the Rocky Mountains, but McBride names the Atlantic, employing modern terminology, while Woodruff describes the Hill Cumorah and East Sea, employing Book of Mormon terminology. A key difference between revisionist and traditionalist Book of Mormon geographers is where they place the Hill Cumorah. Salvage the historicity of the Book of Mormon by insisting on two Cumorahs, Mormon's Cumorah and Moroni's Cumorah, one in Mesoamerica and the other in New York State. Traditionalists balk at this theory, countering that Joseph Smith and those associated with him knew of only one Cumorah, an innocuous drumlin in the proximity of Manchester, New York. The first step in sorting out whether the Zelf episode contributes to a resolution of this controversy is considering the question which of either phrasing echoes Smith's vernacular. There is some evidence of Scandi that McBride's phrasing was not foreign to Joseph Smith's vernacular. Far West, according to Thomas B. Marsh, an enraged Smith warned his persecutors that, quote, if he was not let alone, he would be a second Muhammad to this generation, and that he would make it one gore of blood from the Rocky Mountains to the Atlantic Ocean, end quote. Other participants at the Far West rally questioned the authenticity of this affidavit, accusing Marsha of being, quote, unquestionably instigated by the devil when he made this statement, end quote. Perhaps the greatest strength of McBride's reading is the strong parallel juxtaposition of proper names, Atlantic and Rocky Mountains. But it is possible to argue that there is an even stronger parallelism in the juxtaposition of the two word phrases, Hill Cumorah, East Sea, and Rocky Mountains. Each of the two word phrases function as proper names and also at least partially describe the designated geographical site. However, the strongest argument in favor of Woodruff's wording is its echoing of Book of Mormon terminology. McBride's language is in contrast inserts modern references such as the Atlantic. Admittedly, Rocky Mountains in Woodruff's account is a modern term, but presents a slightly different problem since there is no Book of Mormon equivalent for these mountains. The issue of whether or not Joseph Smith would have identified the New York Hill as Cumorah is important because revisionists have claimed that the hill, quote, in New York was probably given the name Cumorah by Oliver Cowdery, end quote, in 1835. According to this theory, references to Joseph Smith to Cumorah prior to 1835 would be impossible. The Woodruff Journal, which dates from mid to late 1834, in and of itself nullifies this theory. In fact, evidence indicates that Cumorah was identified in New York even prior to the disinterment of Zelf's corpse in 1834. Clearly, Joseph Smith associated the coming forth of the Book of Mormon with the Hill Cumorah. In an open letter to the church dictated 6th of September, 1842, he reflected, quote, and again, what do we hear? Glad tidings from Cumorah. Moroni, an angel from heaven, declaring the fulfillment of the prophet, the book to be revealed, end quote. Oliver Cowdery, as I have already noted, in 1835, had identified the Manchester Hill as Cumorah Rama, the gruesome scene of the genocide of the Nephites and the Jaredites. In the same year, Parley P. Pratt independently published a song aptly titled The Opening of the Dispensation of the Fullness of Times that poetically memorialized the coming forth of the Book of Mormon, quote, lo, from Cumorah's lonely hill, there comes a record of God's will, end quote. David Whitmer recounted an event from 1829 to Joseph F. Smith and Orson Pratt, although years later in 1878. While in transit from Harmony to Fayette in 1829, he encountered a very pleasant, nice-looking old man, who in response to an invitation for a ride said, quote, no, I am going to Cumorah, end quote. Whitmer admitted why he so clearly remembered the esoteric name. Quote, this name was something new to me. I did not know what Cumorah meant, end quote. Although the issue of memory complicates Whitmer's assertion, a reference to Cumorah's location was published in January 1833, a year and a half before the Army of Zion discovered Zelf. Quote, in the year 1827, William W. Phelps editorialized, the plates came forth from the Hill Cumorah, which is in the county of Ontario and state of New York, by the power of God, end quote. From such sources, it is evident that Joseph Smith could have used the word Cumorah in 1834. And in fact, Smith dictated a letter, which we'll discuss in just a second here, the day after the event, which clearly identifies the camp's discovery of the Indian skeletons as the remains of Book of Mormon people, implicitly the Nephites. Woodruff's language, which is more intimately connected with the Book of Mormon language, should then be given priority over McBride's. It is probably closer to that used by the prophet. Now, if you turn to the page, we'll go to the last two sources I'm going to discuss here. I've got some others I was going to show you here. If anyone's interested, you're more than welcome to come up. And now's a good time to wake up. This is really interesting, isn't it? And I had to write the thing, so... We want to discuss first Ebert E. Howe's. This was another one that Ken Godfrey overlooked in his recent Farms publication. Famed Mormon antagonist Ebert E. Howe has left an invaluable source for the Zelf episode, the only contemporary non-Mormon account in this study. When Howe published his seminal anti-Mormon work, Mormonism Unveiled, in November of 1834, the discovery of the bones of a human skeleton did not escape his attention. The significance of Howe's account cannot be underestimated. It was published just 5 short months after the event and is told by an outsider. This final point is particularly important because there was nothing in the discovery itself which would have suggested to Howe the narrative he relates. Howe's account must have been based on sources who were eyewitnesses to the finding of Zell's skeleton. This account provides several critical insights. Howe concurs with Woodruff's versions that the exhumation took place at the direct instigation of Joseph Smith. Howe estimates that they dug down about 1 foot from the top of the ground, as with Heber C. Kimball's journal. Howe also acknowledges, as does Kimball, Woodruff, and Martin, that Smith was prophesying or inspired when he gave his interpretation of the bones. According to Howe, Smith said that the bones were the remains of a celebrated general among the Nephites. Kimball similarly has Smith identifying Zelph as, quote, an officer who fell in battle, end quote. Howe's comment also corresponds to Woodruff's tradition that Zelph fought for the Nephites. Howe claims that Smith specified the general's name, Zelph, and by the various accounts, and cited the tumultuous war which left him dead. This war was said by Smith to have occurred, quote, some 1,500 years ago, end quote, over the genocide of the Nephites. Not mentioned in any other sources, Howe remarks that the skeletal remains, quote, were carefully laid out upon a board, end quote. That's about the only unique element in it. All the other elements can be reconstructed from the other sources. What then, and this is the interesting part, you know, you want to listen to this, I mean. What then were the essential elements of Joseph Smith's self-vision? The evidence suggests that a number of ideas in the various accounts originate with Smith. In my judgment, these include the following. The skeleton belonged to Zelph, a man of God, a warrior and an officer, a white Lamanite from whom the curse had been removed. Zelph was embroiled in a battle serving under the prophet King Onondagus, who was known and possibly reigned from the hill Cumorah or East Sea to the Rocky Mountains. As a young warrior, Zelph had received a compound fracture to his femur from an object thrown from a sling of an enemy. This leg eventually healed and Zelph fought again. But he was finally killed with an arrow in battle, which occurred just prior to the final decline and extermination of the Nephite nation around 400 CE. The Zelph vision may have included much more than this, but I believe it included at least this much. I have purposely left one source until last. It is the first in importance in chronology and was dictated by Joseph Smith. And that's the final source that you see there from Joseph Smith. It's a letter that he wrote to Emma Smith the day after. Joseph Smith does not mention Zelph explicitly, but he provides the context in which he viewed the discoveries he and his colleagues had made. Dictating to his wife, Emma, on the 4th of June, 1834, the day after Zelph's disinterment, Smith depicted his troops as, quote, wandering over the plains of the Nephites, recounting occasionally the history of the Book of Mormon, end quote. Smith was moved by the grisly yet awesome scene of mounds filled with bodies of, quote, that once beloved people of the Lord, end quote, the Nephites. Quote, picking up their bones, Smith reflected, as a proof of the Book of Mormon's divine authenticity, end quote. Zelph was an integral part of this scene. Revisionists have suggested that Joseph Smith's vision of the white Lamanite described a man who lived after the close of Nephite history and wandered far from his homeland. But this argument seems particularly wrong-headed, since Smith himself, the day after the vision, interpreted the remains as the deceased Indians of the deceased Indians in terms of, quote, the history of the Book of Mormon, end quote, indeed, quote, as a proof of its divine authenticity, end quote. Zelph was part of Nephite history, albeit an unrecorded segment. A documentary analysis of the Zelph episode pits the rationalistic assumptions of the revisionists against the faith assumptions of the traditionalists. Revisionist Book of Mormon geographers are correct that it is impossible with our present scientific knowledge to posit the theory that the Indians are descendants of an Israelite community whose culture spanned the entire Western Hemisphere. But traditionalists are correct that Joseph Smith posited precisely this theory. But each of these victories is ultimately hollow. Revisionists may find validity in the Book of Mormon in their Mesoamerican geographical models, but only at the expense of Joseph Smith and the text and interpretations he produced. Traditionalists may find solace that Joseph Smith and all believed that all the Western Indians from the tip of South America to the highest regions of North America descended from the tribes of Israel, but only at the expense of virtually everything scientists have learned about the biological origin of the American Indians in the past 100 years. Joseph Smith's discovery of an unidentifiable skeleton, to which he ascribed a detailed history of a white Lamanite named Zelph, is characteristic of a number of Smith's revelations. He saw wonderful tales and artifacts which had nothing to do with the meanings he imputed to them. From a set of crudely forged plates which had been deposited in Kinderhook, Illinois, with the intention of tricking Smith, he affirmed that he had translated the history of a Jaredite progeny of Pharaoh. In a group of Egyptian funeral texts with their accompanying vignettes, the prophet perceived the travails of Father Abraham and details of his curious cosmology. Salvific temple rituals extending to the dawn of creation were seen by Smith beneath the late medieval fraternal rites of Freemasonry. And so was Zelph. The decaying bones of an unknown Hopewell Indian provided the catalyst for Joseph Smith's prophetic imagination to envision the legend of a Nephite warrior who fought valiantly under the prophet King Onondagas. Defeated in death, he was victorious in life through his conversion to Christ, which transformed his dark Lamanite skin to the pure pigmentation of his Nephite brothers. Finally, the arrowhead, which was likely placed ritualistically on the deceased Indian's body, became, in Smith's vision, the fatal instrument which snuffed out the life of Zelph, a white Lamanite. Thank you.
Now it's my turn. I think Brent's done a fine job in looking at the evidence that is there. However, I think he's carried it beyond the seed of what it really is. I envision the Zelph quote-unquote episode as part of the Zion's Camp movement. The Zion's Camp movement occurred in May and June of 1834. Joseph Smith rallied 200-plus men and women to go to Missouri to rescue the saints. Now, he was practicing tactics and strategy with his men, and he was rallying his men as a general would rally his troops. So naturally, a couple of days before this event, they were wandering through some mounds, and Joseph was depressed, and it's recorded in the history of the church. He says, "Why are you so depressed?" "Well, we're passing through an area where a great battle occurred." What's he doing? He's getting these people ready to fight. And so they come up on these mounds, and we don't know who went up to the mounds. I want to make that one thing clear. We don't even know who was there and who witnessed this event to occur. As Brent was saying, the closest we have in a reality, actual account of the time is Reuben McBride's, when he writes that we went up to the mountain and Joseph said thus and such. Okay? But what he was doing was he was getting some sort of battle, like I was saying. And I really think that that's what it's all about. I don't see any connection at all with Book of Mormon geography, because those people knew, as it said in the 1830 edition of the Book of Mormon, the book came from Manchester, New York. So naturally, they would think that the Hill Cumorah was in New York, right? And the Eastern Sea would be the Atlantic Ocean. Anyway, that's something that I want to point out, is that the only real primary source we have is Reuben McBride's, and everything else is an interpretation thereof. And I don't think Brent's paper should be called a documentary. I think it should be called an exegesis of the Zelph episode, because that's what it really is. He's taken the text and he's taken volumes of material that people have interpreted out of this and made it something that it really isn't. You know, I think he's right in that they went up on the hill and Joseph picked up a bone. Here's a watch. I'll pick up a watch. Let's see. I'm an archaeologist and I pick up a watch and I say, well, I think this watch is 19th century because it looks, it's made of gold and this and that. And I think it's this old and this such. But he really doesn't say, you know, we really don't know what Joseph said. Like he says, this is Zelph, a white Lamanite. Well, I've never seen a skeleton with bones on it, so I don't know how he could have known it was white. And we're talking about two separate events here, too. You have to excuse me if my thoughts are a little rattled. I didn't have a lot of time to prepare for this, but that I've had time to think about this. But I think when we're talking about a century, okay, I'm going to vary off a little bit. They gave us men like Ignatius Donnelly. He wrote Atlantis, the Antediluvian World. And when Ignatius Donnelly would look at something and he thought it was Atlantis related, he thought that everything came from Atlantis. Are anybody here familiar with that or his book? Okay, one person is. Anyway, and I'd like to also quote, there is a parallel that does exist, if I can find my paper, in the search. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm talking right into it. Is it? What? Oh, I'm sorry.
I just have an unusually loud voice.
So sorry, Brent. Okay. There is a parallel, okay, that I want to point out. Michael Wood did this wonderful series on PBS called In Search of the Trojan War, and he was talking about Heinrich Schliemann and his search for Agamemnon in the city of Mycenae. And in 1876, Schliemann was digging in the ruins of Mycenae, and this is what he discovered. Climax of his search came in the fifth and for him last tomb, where, as with the jewels of Helen, Sleeman found exactly what he had wished so passionately to find. There were three male bodies, richly adorned with inlaid war, accoutrements, gold, etc., etc., had been wonderfully preserved under its ponderous gold mask, both eyes perfectly visible, also the mouth, which, owing to the enormous weight, had been pressed down. Okay, that may be boring to you. The man must have died at the early age of 35. The news of that well-preserved body, of a mythic heroic age, had been found, spread like wildfire through the Argonaut, and the people came by thousands from Argos, Naphtola, and the villages to see the wonder. And Sleeman also sent a telegram to the king of Greece saying, I have gazed upon the face of Agamemnon. Well, later we discover that he was 1,000 years off and he was way wrong. And here was a trained archaeologist picking up a piece of history saying, this is Agamemnon. And he was dead wrong. He was 100 years off. So I don't have any trouble with Joseph Smith picking up a piece of bone of an Hopewell Indian saying, well, I think this was Zelph, but I'm not sure, you know. And then we have this tradition of a vision. We don't know when it occurred and of the next day. So I really don't think that this argument has anything to do with Book of Mormon geography. I think it was a rallying cry. Joseph Smith was trying to rally his people and get them ready to go to Missouri. And his whole argument of bringing in the white skin, and that to me is irrelevant. There's a lot of things in this paper that are really irrelevant, I think, to the central issue. And that's, what is Zelph really all about? And like I said, I think it's just a rallying cry for the troops to get them all excited to go to war. Anyway, that's about all I've got to say.
Okay, Brent wants 2 seconds of response to the comments,
and then
I'll take some questions. We can stay until 10 after if you promise to run.
Okay, I'll just be really brief here. I don't really have to disagree with Tim because Joseph Smith does it for me. To say that this has nothing to do with the Book of Mormon is absolutely ludicrous, because I'm not just talking about Reuben McBride. I'm talking about Joseph Smith, which happens to be, by the way, the earliest document to the Zelph episode. Reuben McBride's was probably not written until about 4 or 5 days after the Zelph episode. This is written the next day, right from the horse's mouth, saying, Book of Mormon history. Proof, these bones, a proof of its divine authenticity. And the accounts are virtually unanimous, with the exception of McBride and Hancock. Those are the only two that don't say that Joseph Smith claimed he was inspired, had a vision, and that's how he got the information. So I think it's very relevant. But lest I be accused of plagiarism when the chapter comes out, my psychological model for why it was being told is almost the same as Tim's. And that is that I think he was preparing the men to die, basically. And he was saying, this is a mighty warrior who is a white Lamanite. He fought on behalf of the prophet King Onondagas, and that may be what we have to do, because things were getting really nerve-wracking. In fact, according to George A. Smith, when they arrived there the day before, on Monday, June 2nd, one of the first concerns that Joseph Smith has when he arrives in camp is he's concerned about their placement. They're in the midst of a clump of trees, and he's concerned that they're going to be ambushed. So, I mean, this is an issue that's right at the forefront. So, again, you know, I'll just let Joseph Smith disagree with Tim on that one. Now, if I can restate it accurately, you're saying that you don't think that Kimball had diaries that early.
Well, that's what Stan.
That's right, and I would concur with that. The only thing I'm suggesting from the Kimball extracts is that they predate the writing of the manuscript history in 1843. See, they could have been written in 1840, though. You see, they don't have to go back to the time. In fact, I don't think it does. And I don't know. By the way, a lot of the background information on that particular series of articles that appeared in the Times and Seasons came directly from Stan Kimball's work on the Heber C. Kimball journals. So.
Thank you.
He didn't recount the experience.
No, he doesn't recount the experience to Emma. Brent, what he does,
not specifically, but in general.
I think part of it is to essentially give a statement on the general atmosphere of what was going on in the camp. It may be introspective. I mean, I could speculate all day on, you know, a psychological model for why Joseph Smith is writing this stuff in his letters to Emma. But I think it gives a very, very true-to-life atmosphere of what was occurring right at that time. And the mounds were a big issue. That was something that was coming up to them. Actually, the mound, as I understand it from the literature, is known as the Naples-Russell number 8 mound. And it's located on top of a bluff, according to the various accounts, that's about 300 feet high. The mound itself, I've heard variations anywhere from 50 to 100 feet in height. And there are mounds in the immediate vicinity that have, in fact, been excavated. Part of this was published as a series of books that was put out by the Illinois Department of Transportation. And in fact, I should have brought one of them with me just so that you could see it. All this information right now is just in the footnotes. I really haven't had time to develop that in the text yet, and certainly nowhere near enough time to present it here today. But basically, what they discover is that they're at the Middle Woodland period, is what it seems to emerge from, which I believe is right around 100 BC to around 400 AD, which is, in actual fact, Book of Mormon time period. Wrong people, not Israelites, but they evidently are the Hopewell Indian culture. And in fact, the Hopewell Indian culture originally was considered to be a burial cultus. And now they're seeing that they're much more developed and so on. But this evidently is part of that context.
Yes.
Where did I quote from? I'm sorry.
23:18.
Yes. In fact, in the original version of this paper, which has been edited. Unfortunately, I actually had the statement that in the first case it was implicit, and in the second case it was explicit. And by virtue of your question, that will most likely be put back into the text, because that's an important distinction.
Have you checked the manuscript history
B1 is of a later time period and doesn't cover this episode. It doesn't cover Zelf. What you're talking about there, I think, is the differences between Book A1 and Book A2. B1 actually covers a later time period and is unrelated to the Zelf episode. But in manuscripts A1 and A2, I in fact have an extended discussion talking about the differences and similarities and that kind of thing. Again, you know, you just don't have time to get into all those details. But again, there are important ones that I don't want to just skirt over. The deletion of Hill Cumorah, for example. The deletion of Last out of Last Struggle among the Lamanites and that kind of thing. And those will all be treated.
When you talk about revisionist geography, you also mentioned the Times and Seasons article on putting Abraham in
That's actually part of the extended chapter where I go through six geographical identifications supposedly given by Joseph Smith, and I list them in the order of the least likely to have come from Joseph Smith to the most likely. Zelf is number 6. Zarahemla happens to be number 2. I think that I can show convincingly that John Taylor was the author of those articles. And in addition, Sorensen and others have tried to argue that in that article, that Joseph Smith, which the article is not under his name, was arguing for a limited geography with the Isthmus of Tehuantepec as the narrow neck of land. But what a lot of these revisionist geographers don't realize is the one quote that I read to you from DNC 128, where Joseph Smith is clearly associating the Hill Cumorah with the coming forth of the Book of Mormon, was written less than a month prior to that, and the first time it was published was in that very periodical, in that very issue. The very one that they're trying to argue Joseph Smith was coming up with a new model of geography. So, anyway, that's all part of the rest of it.
I just like
Kimball 1845. The history originally 1843 and then published in that form in 1846. And then Woodruff, I would place mid to late 1834.
So Woodruff comes after McDonald.
Yes, in sequence. There are four.
Joseph Smith never talks about Zell.
There are four.
Apparently, he's talking about the some kind of
what are even the last Lamanites? Yeah, what does that mean?
No, Nephites.
Nephites. Does that mean descendants of Nephites?
Well, he says it is because he says, you know, proof of its divine authenticity, roving over the mounds of this once beloved people of the Lord.
Before the Zell incident?
No.
Maybe because he talks about it a couple of days before then.
There are four documents that I would consider the primary documents for understanding this, and I would put them in this chronological order of them being written. I would place the Joseph Smith letter first, Reuben McBride second, Wilford Woodruff possibly third, and then Ebert E. Howe next. All of them in 1834.
Okay, way in the back.
Certainly is no historical basis for any of the Zell episodes, but Joseph was the kind of person who presented that such characters actually did exist. And if so, what does this tell us about other things that he did say and write?
Well, we had a president of the United States.
Okay, can we just stand up?
We had a president of the United States who fictionalized movies in his account. Reagan made reference